Welcome to the Keys of the Kingdom with Brother Gregory of His Holy Church.
Welcome to Keys of the Kingdom. I'm Brother Gregory, and we're going to talk about the Kingdom of God. What we're going to be talking about is a little bit about this structure of a system that allows people to become free. And that's what Abraham was about. That's what Moses was about. That's what Jesus Christ was about. They were showing a way in which society could structure itself, organize itself, so that the individual rights, which God has bestowed us with, these things we sometimes want to call inalienable rights, remain intact. And yet, we remain strong as a society so that other, like bullies, can't come in, you know, invading armies or bullies or thugs or gangs can't come in and wreak havoc with the innocent lives of people. Because that's why governments are instituted. Governments are instituted to protect you mostly from foreign invasion. In other words, the invasion of thugs and robbers and murderers. I always thought it was kind of interesting. We talk about Monaco, which is, you know, a kingdom out there along the Mediterranean. And it's where Grace Kelly ended up being, you know, Prince Grace. And, you know, they have the royal family of Monaco. And you think, well, okay, these are royalty and everything. And really how that kingdom got started was there was a monastery there that was heavily influencing the people. It dealt mostly in charity. And, you know, it wasn't taxing people or anything like that. But it was, you know, providing for the local communities. But it became fairly wealthy. And this is what the church was. It was the welfare system of the people. If there was a need or if there was an emergency or there was things like health, education, and welfare, this was usually handled through the church. And it was handled by free will offerings of the people. Anyway, a group of pirates came to the monastery and, you know, knocked on the door. They opened the door and they rushed in and killed all the monks. And eventually took over that whole area, and that became Monaco. And now the descendants of those people, there may have been a change of hands from time to time, but basically that's how that government got established. It was they took it by the sword, and they established themselves as royalty or noblemen by the sword. Now, that's not always the case. Sometimes people were actually noble and defending, you know, like Saul. There was injustice in the land. People were getting away with, literally, getting away with murder. And Saul gathered men together and stopped it. Stopped that murdering group that was bringing injustice into the community and abusing people. And he became very popular because of that, and so they made him king. And then when they gave him the power of a kingship, this power to exercise authority one over the other, it corrupted him. Now, what did that look like when they gave him this kingship as opposed to what he was before, which was just private citizen like everybody else, who a lot of people were willing to follow and back up? And so he was able to take literally an army of volunteers and stop the evildoers that were abusing people in their nation, in their communities. And but when he became a king, something else was going to happen. And it tells you in Samuel 8 that what's going to happen if you give somebody this power to be a ruler over people, he will end up taking and taking and taking and taking. Now, it didn't start out that way with Saul. He didn't take and take and take and take at first. It was long into his reign, and he was fearing the Philistines, a bunch of thugs who were going to come in and invade. We're going to, you know, and kill and murder and rape and pillage. And he was needing to prepare his army. But now he's a king. He can't just look for volunteers. And he didn't think we had enough supplies to man this army and move troops across the country and keep them fed and fight the enemy. So he forced a sacrifice. All he did was he taxed the people. That's the peace offering. He taxed the people. He said, okay, everybody has to give this much, you know, or portion this much. And that was considered a foolish thing, and that's why he was told his kingdom would not last. But of course, back in Samuel 8, they said this is what will end up happening. He will take the first fruits. He will take the best of your fields. He will take and take and take and even take your sons and daughters. In other words, draft them into his armies. And you won't be free people anymore. You'll be subject to this ruler that you have elected for yourselves, which was called a rejection of God. And this is what we've been doing throughout the ages. We've either been moving towards liberty under God, where the individual is free, or moving away from God to systems that force the contributions of the people. And those are the two kinds of governments that you can have in the world today. And there's many variations of the ones that force the contributions of the people. Some are communist countries, some are socialist countries, some are democracies, some are social democracies. You know, there's all kinds of different ones, constitutional republics. All these different kinds of governments end up, because they create an office of power, they end up forcing the people to contribute to the welfare of the people. We used to educate most of the people in this country, the best education probably in the world, and the most educated population in the world. Almost everybody in America could read at one time compared to anywhere else in the world. And they could do this by free schools, by private schools, where people could go. And if you didn't have enough money, they always made allowances to let you in. Even Harvard was that way. Anybody could have got a Harvard education back in the early days of America. If they could keep the grades up, they could get one because it was written right into their charter. They didn't have to pay tuition if they could not afford tuition. And many people went there and got an education, a college education, and they weren't charged anything. They were hopingly going to pay some of that back as alumni, and often did, but it wasn't a student loan like we do today. You actually got a free education if you were too poor to pay for it, even all the way up to college. And we did this through free will offerings. That's what made America great. Nothing else made America great. That willingness to help other people out when you had enough to help them. You had two coats, your neighbor had none. You share. You have enough money to educate. My own great-great-grandfather, he was a farmer, became a wealthy man in the Dakotas farming. By the time he was 45, he was able to retire. And he had lots of money coming in. He put numerous children through not only high school, but college. He just picked them out and he paid for their college because he thought they were, you know, and they, when they went to college, they worked hard and got good grades. They didn't, like most kids do today, they go to college as a fountain of knowledge and they all go there to drink. They actually went and worked and made something. I mean, even the one-room schoolhouse my own dad went to, it produced several admirals, congressmen, a vice president, and my dad. I mean, it was a one-room schoolhouse because people really valued the education that they were getting and appreciated the people that were helping pay for those educations often. Student loans, another attitude. I know numerous people who have gotten student loans and actually are avoiding getting a good job because if they get a good job, they have to start paying their student loan back. And there's actually a rule, I guess, somehow or other it works. I don't know. If you leave the country, the clock stops ticking on your student loan. So they have actually taken trips to, like, New Zealand and Taiwan. Or no, it wasn't Taiwan. Thailand. And just so that their student loans didn't start kicking in and accumulating interest. That's what we've created. And student loans have created an educational system that costs 2, 3, 4, 5, in some cases 10 times what it used to cost. Because why should the college cut back? Why should the college tighten their own belt? Why should the college make sure that the professors are actually teaching the kids and the kids are getting skills where they are actually going to become viable and contributing members of society because they don't need to worry about the alumni? See, when you gave away an education to a young man who is hardworking and talented in hopes that he would become an alumni and eventually contribute back to the school so that you could do this with somebody else, you perpetuated a certain kind of relationship with your students and with your alumni, etc., that produced more of this philanthropic, altruistic attitude in your alumni. They wanted to see the next student who was going to come in and couldn't afford an education but make something out of his life and become successful. Even when they graduated from school, the alumni who already had a business or whatever, they would want to pull from that group and make them successful, bringing more successful alumni up in the world that could contribute back to the school. And so this was an investment of charity in hope that it would return. That's a very different spirit than what we see going on in the world today with things like student loans and welfare and food stamps and all this stuff. It isn't the kind of charity that strengthens the poor. It really doesn't even qualify as charity. But it has been ingrained into our system and it is producing a certain kind of person. That's where the snowflakes all come from that we talk about today. They can't see it. They can't see how they are changed by this socialistic approach to charity, which kills charity. It actually, what it does is it kills care. People don't care about other people. They don't practice caring about other people. They don't have to personally sacrifice to care about other people. Oh, they can care about them from a distance. You know, they can think, oh, I want to vote that in because that will help the poor. No, it doesn't help the poor. It weakens the poor. And of course, that's the sin of Sodom and Gomorrah. And I bring this up because it's a dividing line, one of the dividing lines, many dividing lines, between the system that God was promoting through Abraham, actually through Enoch, through Moses, through the early church, and the system that has been promoted by the Cains of this world, the Nimrods of this world, the Sauls of this world, and the evil pharaohs and Caesars of this world. These are two different systems, and they have a nature to them, and they have a certain particular form to them. And some of the form is the same in both. Both systems are well organized, one from the top down, one from the bottom up. Both systems are funded by the people, one by force, one by free will offerings. But they are actually systems. And the difference is that the system that is based on charity and love for one another and honor for one another, because when those people are alumni and they've made a fortune now because they got a good education and got good jobs, good, you know, engineers or whatever, and they're contributing back to society, they take a portion of what they make and they send it back to their alma mater, to the school that helped them get to where they are today. And the school works very hard to get them trained to that point so that they will have an alma mater someday that will, and they will have alumni someday that will pay back to the alma mater. And that's a good thing. It's a very good plan. It's not a guarantee of morality in all the choices of everybody, but that's life. Life's not a guarantee. But it alters the character of the people and therefore alters the character of society. If you do it the other way, by force, by socialism or communism or compelled offerings, you know, like they tried to do at the time of Gladys of England, who was also I was trying to think of, for some reason it escapes me, so we'll just go on. But there were times back in around 1090 where the kings were trying to force a tax to fund the church, to fund what was called religion in those days, which was what took care of the needy of society, you know, the hospitals, the libraries, the educational facilities for educating the people. And even taking care of the elderly sometimes when their families broke down, you know, widows and orphans. Oh, Lady Godiva, that was it. Lady Godiva, she opposed that tax. And she didn't strip off her clothes, but she stripped off her wealth and she built hospitals all over the known world. The same thing was going on later with another great woman, which they should make a movie about, which was the mother of King Richard and King John. And she was an exceptional woman. I mean, she traveled all over the world, was captured. She built hospitals. She built all kinds of care facilities for people and everything. And it was all privately funded out of her own wealth. And people used to do that all the time. And they were adored because of that. And they were helped. People sacrificed to help these people. And it was a different kind of spirit. Now, there are also selfish people around as well. But actually, there's a rich history for about 1,000 years after Christ and the decline and fall of the Roman Empire that there were communities all over the world that operated in that fashion. No taxes, free will offerings, volunteer militia, volunteer to help the charity and the poor. How did they work? This is one of the best kept secrets of our time. Nobody actually reveals to you how they work. And, you know, the form is pretty consistent, although that varies a little bit from here to there. But there are certain principles that remain the same. And we talked in the earlier two shows about the Levites and how the Levites operated in their system. And there's a very great confusion about what the Levites were really doing. And part of that confusion existed even way back at the time of Christ. The Pharisees thought they knew what the Levites were doing and were preaching a particular form of Judaism, and they were wrong. They were not in agreement with Moses. They thought they were, but they weren't. According to Jesus Christ, they didn't know him because they didn't know Moses, yet they claim Moses as their leader and founder. But they weren't doing what Moses said. They were doing something else. Now, there were Jews at that time who were doing what Moses said, and we talked about them too, which were the Levites. And not the Levites, excuse me, the Essenes. Some of the Levites were Essenes. Because Essenes is not, you know, it wasn't a homogeneous group. It was a particular way of thinking. And they all read the Torah, but they didn't believe in animal sacrifice. They believed that the Pharisees' interpretation of the altars of stone and clay and the animal sacrifice was a fiction and a fraud. They didn't do that. They had Passover and they had all the other things, but they didn't do that animal sacrifice. So what did they think those stone altars were? What did they think those altars of clay and stone were all about? If they didn't think that they were piling up stone and burning up sheep, what did they think that that meant? And of course, we tell about that in the book, Thy Kingdom Comes, which is free online. And we tell about it in a lot of articles and a lot of other audios that we have available. But how does that relate today? How do we relate what was going on with the Levites back then in the early days of Israel when it was still a republic, hadn't become a kingdom yet, hadn't spent 1,000 years in apostasy? It was still a free nation that could not be defeated. And we don't have a very clear picture of what they do. Even the translations are full of misconceptions. And it carries all the way down to the modern Quran, who has a lot of those misconceptions rewritten in it. And so what were all those? And I mean, it's a monumental task to try to uncover all this and rewrite it so that you can see, looking back at the actual Hebrew language, looking back on those sources that have actually survived over thousands of years, and we lay it out. We can't prove it absolutely, but then, of course, the kingdom of heaven, the church, is not established by proof, but by revelation. It's not by flesh and blood, not by the perfect argument that with all the evidence that what we say is true, that you're going to believe this. No matter how much evidence we provide, and we have a lot of evidence, but no matter how much, you're not going to believe it unless it's written on your heart, because this is what you have to be seeking. If you want to seek the kingdom of God and his righteousness, you have to seek the ways of Christ. And we're going to go through all that over the probably next couple of months and put together a whole series on how this all works. So we've gone through some of the early quotes of the Levites. We started with a particular page that's connected to our denominations page. We're non-denominational. We think there's only one denominator in Christianity, and that's Christ. If you're not conforming to Christ, and you're actually doing things contrary to Christ, then you're not with him. And this is what we were sharing this morning is some of those things, and we're going to go into a lot of those things, and you might be surprised that your church may actually be doing the exact opposite of what Christ said. And if we can prove that to you, that's great. But unless it's written in your heart, it's not going to do you any good. But we're going to give it our best shot. The Levites, members of the same tribe, Levites were supposedly members of the same tribe, and this is, I'm reading from somebody else here, but who were not descendants of Aaron, not necessarily direct descendants of Aaron, served as aides to the priests of the tabernacle and the tabernacle of the congregation. And that tabernacle of the congregation is simply the tents of the congregation. They were actually serving the individual homes or tents of the congregation. These are metaphors. Originally, they were just tents because they were a nomadic people for at least 40 years there. Then eventually it was homes and structures and everything, but they still called it tents because they were serving the tents of the congregations of the people. And how did they serve them? They were health, education, and welfare. So how did that all work? And can I present a believable argument about that? Doing things like helping to prepare the sacrifice. This is what the guy writes. Well, what was the sacrifice for? You think it's just for killing sheep and setting them on fire and burning them up so the smoke goes up to heaven and makes God happy, well, you know, I can't really help you because you don't have any idea what the Levites were really doing. But the sacrifice was actually for a purpose. There were free will offerings. There were, all of them are free will offerings, but there were sin offerings. There were heave offerings. There were peace offerings. All these different kind of offerings, and they were all to go to the Levites, and this was a rule that was to go on forever. Well, we don't do that to the Levites anymore because the Levites were replaced. The Levites were the church in the wilderness, called out in order to be the priests of a nation. In each individual house, you still had the priest of your own household, which was someone in your family, usually one of your oldest sons. Firstborn was usually the priest in the household. And that had a particular role within the family. And the king in each household was the head of the family, the father, usually a grandfather often. And that was the king and priest in each household, each family grew. But the Levites were a priest to a nation. They were going to take all the value that we have in the family bonds and strengthen them, not just in a family, but in a nation. Why? Because there's lots of thugs out there. There's disasters out there. There's calamities out there that can strike a whole community and just wipe out that community. And unless your community is a broad-based community, a nation of people, you know, like if you have a drought in the Southwest or you have, you know, snowstorms or floods or earthquakes or whatever, you need aid coming in from afar. If you're invaded, you know, if Washington State was invaded, would anybody from Oregon go up there and help them? Well, no, that's the federal government's job. Well, how does the federal government have money to? Well, they took it from you. How do they have soldiers? Well, they got some people to join up, but if they run out, they can just draft you. That's all what happens when you're not ruled by God. But if you were ruled by God, if you were actually doing what those Levites were doing and the first century church was doing and what Abraham was doing when they were invaded and one city-state after another fell to this invading army, Abraham mustered an army overnight, just overnight. And it was such a successful army, it defeated this other army overnight. You know, one night they defeated them. How did they do that? How were they able to do that? Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of men show up, supply lines, people coming with supplies from a long ways off, and they defeat this enemy overnight. And there's no limit to the size of such an army that you could produce overnight. But there would be a different kind of change because it's a different kind of army. It's brought together in a different kind of way, because it's following the way of Christ. So what is that way and how does that work? Again, back to these Levites helping to prepare a sacrifice. Well, it wasn't just to burn up sheep. It was to take care of the widows and orphans and needy of society, to take care of the needs of society in calamities or whatever. They talk about some of them doing repairs on the temple. Well, the temple is originally just a church. And you don't have an entire tribe working on repairing this tent, which was the original temple. I said church, but I mean, you know, temple. But that temple was just a tent that moved around from place to place. It said they served as musicians, and I'm telling you that that word musicians didn't mean that they just played instruments, but they helped harmonize the people, got them to work together. Singers were not, they were like the old minstrels. They might sing a message, but they were actually bringing you reports from other parts of the kingdom telling you what was going on in this part. I mean, that's what minstrels actually did. They were heralds. They went around, and it was easy to put it to song and then remember it. And it was easy for the people to listen and hear the message if it was in song. And so this is the way nations before kings printed out edicts, communicated over large areas to people that might be thousands of people over many, many different valleys. They would send their minstrels, their singers around to do this. Doorkeepers were actually gatekeepers. Gatekeepers were people who received the contributions. Most of the welfare was taken care of in the local communities, but some was always moved up towards this central group in a network. Ministers send up to this minister, and he's connected with 9 other ministers like himself in a group of 10. And if they have a need, some of it will go down right away. It doesn't have to trickle down all the way from the top. It could be diverted there as it's moving up. And wherever it's needed, it's just like a body moving blood around in the circulatory body. And these Levites being the priests of a nation, not just a priest of a family. See, in a family group, it might be an uncle who was the priest of the family group. And if the, you know, another member of the family over here or a member of the family over there needed help, he would divert funds from the family over, you know, from the whole family, and people would contribute. They'd all be in communication to help out this guy. If they had a grandson or even a great grandson who was very talented and needed an education, they would all pitch together. I mean, boat people coming from Vietnam, they did all this. They would put their kids and grandkids who were talented to school. Others, they would put them into business. And they all contribute back to help out the next generation. And they went from absolute poverty to wealth often in a very short period of time in one generation because they had this idea. And that's great for a family. Well, how do you do that on a national basis? You have to have a national priesthood. A national priesthood who is to help out the needy of society. Somebody has a talent and he needs an education. And maybe he needs to go to a trade school. Maybe he needs to go learn welding somewhere. You help him out. He needs to start a business. He needs some capital to start that business. The whole family should pitch in and help him out. And that is to be repeated on a national basis, where you bind communities together not by force, but by charity, which the word we see translated charity often in the Bible, most of the time only in the New Testament, the word never appears in the Old Testament, is also translated love almost every time that Jesus says it. So love and charity are one and the same thing. So this is what the national priest is supposed to be doing, is bringing communities together so that they remember so-and-so helped us out. These guys over here helped us out. And we talked a little bit why you don't just go and help them out yourself. Why do you have a group of men whose job it is to help people out? You have created an office by creating a national priesthood that is an office of service, not an office of power, but an office of service, because he can't force anybody to give him anything. He has to do a good job with what is given him, or you don't give him any more. Wholly different idea than what we're used to. But whole nations used to operate this way. And we're going to talk more about those whole nations. But, you know, we're going to have to take a break. We've already used up a half hour of our time. And so we're going to take a little break here. And we'll be right back to Keys of the Kingdom. Well, welcome back. We're talking to a number of people that have guests on the show, but that's all will be handled through the network of our own ministers, because that ultimately is what we're going to be trying to teach you, is how what the Levites were doing was networking on a national basis. I mean, we all network. We all have family. We have family from England that have married into our family. We have family from Sweden that has married into our family. And so we network with them. My son recently was trying to get up to Portland by a certain time, and his car broke down in a town about 75 miles away. And just a few phone calls later, we had somebody driving through there, was headed through there anyway. Somebody knew somebody who knew somebody. We had somebody pick up his car, could fix it. We got somebody else, but it wouldn't get fixed until the weekend was over. There was a storm coming. Got him all the way up to Portland, which was, you know, 5-6 hour drive away. And it was because we were networking. We had people willing to help people out. Had people stranded, sick in Nevada, in the middle of nowhere. A couple of phone calls. We had somebody come and pick them up and nurse them back to health. That's the way it works in a network. And we're just scratching the surface with that network. What happened if everybody in Charleston, Louisiana had to evacuate? I mean, we had somebody in the Midwest that was looking at possibly having to evacuate because a nuclear power plant was maybe going to go Fukushima. We had people all over the network, and we're still rather small, that were willing to take those families in their home in safe areas. But you don't just build a network like that by putting a telephone number up on a billboard, because you're actually inviting people into your home. I know people who've needed help recently, and I've known about it through the network. I did not lead them to certain families because I didn't know enough about them. I don't see them really seeking the kingdom of God and his righteousness. I mean, they weren't going to starve in the streets, but we could have probably made things a lot easier for them just by me texting them a number. And we had people, somebody else got stranded, and somebody just got in their car and drove hundreds of miles and picked them up. And we can do that. But we're not going to just do that for everybody, because everybody isn't deserving. They shouldn't be helped. It would weaken them to help them. You know, somebody recently was talking about somebody self-medicating, and what they weren't self-medicating, they were getting drunk. To call it self-medicating when somebody gets drunk because they're an alcoholic is enabling them. You're calling it something it's not. No, they're an alcoholic. They need to stand up and say, "Hi, I'm so-and-so. I'm an alcoholic." They need, in order to get better, they have to realize that that isn't medication. That's booze. And you're getting drunk because you're an alcoholic. And that's tough love. If you want to get better, if you want them to get better, you got to call it like it is. That's a prime. Compassion comes from being willing to be honest with people. So that's part of the job of a Levite, too. The whole idea of stoning had nothing to do with picking up rocks and hitting people in the head. Remember, the Levites were the stones of the altar. Now, I know that's a shocker for a lot of people listening, but a lot of people who've listened on a regular basis, they already know. We show that that's what the altars were, always living stones. In the New Testament, we see them referred to them as lively stones. That's because they were always meant to be lively stones. In the days of Abraham and the days of Moses. And you don't believe that because somebody told you something when you were real young. You read something in a translation and you have accepted it. But you have to look at things anew, and that's what we're going to show you, is those things anew. So one of the other things the Levites were also supposed to do was be teachers of Israel. And you see that in Deuteronomy 24:8 and in 33:10. You see it in 2 Chronicles 35:3 and Nehemiah 8:7. So all those places you can go and look. And they also talk about a nation of scribes, which is like in we hear about the scribes in the New Testament, but you can also go to 2 Chronicles 34:13 and see about scribes. What were scribes? The Levites were numbering the people. Well, what that numbering meant was they were counting them. The people were self-organizing themselves into groups of tens, fifties, hundreds, and thousands. And it didn't have to always be tens. It could be 12. It could be 8. The idea is small groups, cell groups. And the Levites were numbering it. In other words, keeping track. And how did they do that? Well, this Levite was the minister of this group. He wasn't a member of that group. He was a minister to that group. He was the connection to the rest of the nation. Because remember, Levites are national priests, a nation of priests. So they're connecting. They're separate from the people, remember. And we've gone through that many times. We have all articles. You can go look on this. They're separate from the people. They're a nation of priests. You don't give them anything except what you want to give them. But you give them everything you want to go into this charitable network of God, which is to support health, education, and welfare in a nation that has no taxes. No taxes whatsoever. No rulers whatsoever. No Congress or Sanhedrin making laws. It's people gathering together in free assemblies with free will offerings to maintain a nation, a national army, which was not a professional army. It was a voluntary army. It was a militia. But occasionally, if they did have to go to war, they were going to need supplies coming in on a regular basis. You know, when I was in the service, somebody would get cookies from home. And everybody showed up at that guy's bunk. And that guy was lucky to get a cookie for himself. But he shared it with everybody else. And if he didn't share it, they all mobbed him and took him anyway. But if they shared them, you know, that was the first thing you do is you share. You learn how to do that. And so anyway, this idea of supporting a whole army is going to take more than just sending cookies now and then, because the army can't live on cookies. It has to be real supplies, real food, real whatever they need. And I told this story recently a couple of times in shows, but they only had ambulances that were horse-drawn. They didn't have very many of them. They had a lot of people getting injured because of artillery and what have you, and the improvement in weaponry. And they had to get these wounded people off the front lines or they just die. And so they needed 2,000 mechanical ambulances, in other words, vehicles, trucks. And they didn't have them in the Army. And the Army never bought them. The people back home in Great Britain, through charity, took up a collection and bought 2,000 ambulances and paid the salaries, the wages, of 4,000 ambulance drivers who went over to ferry these guys back and forth. They weren't a part of the Army. The Army wasn't paying for this. It was all by free will donations. And nobody was surprised. Unheard of today. You wouldn't even think that was possible today with our present mindset. But that's the way they did it. And the hospitals they were taking these ambulances to, who is that? Was that a military hospital? No. They were private hospitals supported by private charity. That's how it works in a free society. We used to do it all the time. We do it less now. We almost don't do it at all. We used to be a great nation. We're not anymore. This is one of the things that we see kind of glimmering back, but people aren't really putting the nail on it. They think, oh, we'll elect this guy and he will take us back to when we were great. No, you got to go back on yourself. Free societies are self-organizing with a moral code, with a care for one another. And that's what we need to get back to. And that's what the churches should really be doing. And that's what Christ was doing, teaching the people how to care about one another. They had to get back to caring about one another and actually putting that care into action. And the Levites were a part of the national priesthood to make that possible. Because there's no way on earth you're going to know who needs help in Washington if you live in Oregon. No way you're going to know that there's a family in Idaho that needs help. Or a family that has a tornado in Kansas. Now, a lot of times when they have these disasters, tornadoes, earthquakes, fires, floods, whatever, local people come out and help. But also local people nowadays come out and start going through your stuff and stealing stuff. You know, I was in a car accident once where the car roof ripped off and everybody was in the car went flying through the air. It was before safety belts, shows you how old I am. And people went flying all over the place in the field and everything. And everybody got up and pretty much walked away except for me. But I was out working in the woods very shortly after that. But I was a little beat up at the time. But nobody stole the thing. Nobody took anything. Everything, all my stuff, all my worldly possessions were in this vehicle that went flying over. And everybody picked them up. I mean, my back pocket where my wallet was, when the cop, when I'm on the gurney there and he's saying, do you have a driver's license? I said, yeah. And he says, can I see it? And I kind of rolled to one side. Yeah, I had broken bones in the shoulder and arm. And I rolled to one side. I said, it's in my back pocket. And he looked down there. He says, you don't have a back pocket. So my whole entire pocket had been ripped off. My pants, it was just gone. Wallet was gone. Everything was gone. And so I didn't have a pocket anymore. And so, but somebody found the wallet, returned it. Amazing. I don't think that happened now. I mean, shortly after that, there was an accident near where I was attending the University of Minnesota. And people came up and says, oh, well, I'm a friend of his. I'll take his suitcases and take him to the hospital. He wasn't a friend. He was just stealing his suitcases. A guy just has an accident, hauled off in an ambulance, and this guy's robbing him. I think it's more so now than ever before. People steal, people rob, people take. There's still good people out there. But part of that networking is to find out who they are. Start networking with those good people. You don't want to be inviting thieves into your house and robbers into your house. You want to be bringing angels into your house. You want to be bringing noble and righteous people into your house and helping them, because those are the people you're going to have to depend on. In order to do that, you have to kind of test people. And that, of course, also was what they were doing with this network of the Levites. Who would be contributors? Who would be there for one another? Who would help one another? And they were connecting all the righteous people, all the noble people, all the honorable people together over a vast network. They had strangers living in their midst. They could become Israelites too. You didn't have to actually be born a Levite to be a Levite. You could be born in the tribe of Reuben and become a Levite. All you had to do is be adopted into a Levite family. And then that Levite family would teach you up and raise you up. You could marry into that family. So it wasn't bloodlines. But there was a pattern to the way in which they got things done. And what they were getting done was making a nation strong so that when Philistines and Amalekites and Amalekites attacked them, they were able to withstand those attacks. When there were famines and floods and earthquakes, they had, you know, whatever the calamity is, they had a way of dealing with it. And this is what the national priesthood of the Levites, entire voluntary force, was doing this. They weren't dividing each other over minor doctrinal issues. They understood the basics are in two commandments. Love God, love your neighbor as yourself. To love your neighbor means to give him a charity that strengthens him, not weakens him. So you know, if somebody is an alcoholic, you don't want to give him $100. I just recently I had a case where, I won't give you all the details, but somebody had a disaster in their family, and they were a pretty irresponsible person, individual. Their husband had run off with another girl who actually was her sister, and left her with kids, and disaster struck, and everybody was supposedly broke up about it, and there was a collection to help out this girl, and they collected thousands of dollars to help her out. Now, numerous people said the money has to go into a trust, and then it will come out of the trust to pay for things as she needs it. That was the plan. Somebody thought, no, just give it to her. And they just gave it to her. And in one weekend, she blew the whole lot with a new boyfriend in another town, staying in a motel, and from the rumors, taking drugs. I mean, how do you blow thousands of dollars in one weekend? I mean, they weren't even in Reno. So anyway, that was stupid. That's not charity. You could have killed them. The kids could have died. As a matter of fact, the new boyfriend is not supposed to be anywhere near children because he already has a record of abuse. I mean, that's his, the court order is that he can't go near anybody's children. And there they take him to another town and blow all this money that people collected. Irresponsible. Absolutely irresponsible. It's not what the Levites would do. Not what they should do. And how do you get Levites who manage those funds properly? And see, that's where stoning comes in. If somebody is being absolutely irresponsible, immoral, neglecting their responsibilities to their family, what have you, and just running around being drunk or alcoholic or a drug addict or lazy or whatever, you tell the Levites. And that's what stoning is, because the Levites are the stones. No Levite, and because they're a network, they know. No Levite's going to help them out until they straighten up their act. Now, if they straighten up their act, there's place for forgiveness. If they go on the wagon, stay sober, start, you know, taking care of their family, well, then they could get help again. And if they don't, they don't get help because they're stoned. They're treated as if they are dead. And that sobers up society really fast. I mean, really fast. And you can't do that without a national priesthood that is funded by charity. And when we started this series, I had read that whole thing with Madison, who said, if Congress can employ money indefinitely to the general welfare and become the sole and supreme judge of that general welfare, what's going to happen? They're going to be teaching your children lies in school. They're going to be paying for sex change operations in prison. They're going to be financing people who are in totally immoral behavior and positions. Irresponsible people. People who, and I can name you these people. People who beat their children, beat their wife, and get a check every month and don't have to go to work. People who say, oh, I can't work because I get headaches, and they just get a check. You know, I get so tired when I have to go to work that I can't work, and so therefore I get a check. They're on disabilities. And the abuse is rampant. I mean, I know these people, and I'm out in the middle of nowhere, and I know these people. How many more are out there? I've seen guys who say, oh, I can't work because I have a bad back. But they're out running around on their four-wheeler. They got plenty of, you know, their back's okay to do other stuff. They sit home, they smoke dope, they drink, and they just squander their whole lives away. But they're on disability. And that goes on all the time. Now, I'm sure some of those people help, but it's destroying this nation. Absolutely destroying this nation. Destroying individually. Because these people need to work. They need to develop their self-esteem. They need to be responsible. And the only way to do that is have a social welfare system based on charity that is operated through a national priesthood. I keep calling it national priesthood. You can call it all kinds of things. Through a church that is connected all over the country and around the world, that is actually trying to help people, get people off drugs, out of alcohol. I mean, there's an easy way to get people off these things if they want. It's amazing what they've been doing in Iceland. They had a tremendous alcohol and drug problem in Iceland with very young people. And if you're taking drugs and alcohol and you're a young person, 14, 15 years old, it can damage you mentally for the rest of your life. And Iceland has turned that around unbelievably. How did they do it? It's easy. But you're not going to find this out with social welfare systems. You're going to find this out with social welfare systems based on faith, hope, and charity, based upon offices of service, not offices of power. And so you have to change your whole thing. And this is what repentance is change your whole thinking and go back. So anyway, I've written a whole document on denominations and how we are led astray. And I've used a particular document that was provided to us by somebody over a year ago, actually 2 years ago now, and almost 2 years ago, and other documents that people have brought up saying that, oh, but I don't see how this Levite thing relates to the early church. Well, we're going to show you how it did and how it relates to Melchizedek, how it relates to Abraham, how it relates to all free governments from the Teutons to James Scott writes a lot about, you know, how to live free of the state. You know, I can't remember exactly what the name of his book is, but it's something along those lines. And he's talking about cultures and how they were surviving without being dominated by other nations who would bring them into subjugation, and how they remain free. And he talks a lot about the social structures and how they located themselves geographically, etc. That isn't necessarily possible anymore, but it is not enough to simply, and we may have guests on the show that we'll talk about this with, it's not enough just to create some sort of survival off the grid approach where you are independent of everybody else. Independence is great, because if you're independent, you're not a burden to other people. But it's absolutely essential that you become a part of a system of charity, of caring about other people, because you're not going to be able to face the ravening wolves that are going to come your way if you're all isolated. You only care about yourself and your family and your immediate friends. Not going to work. You have to have a worldview of independence. In order to do that, you need this national priesthood. Now, you have total control over who you contribute to, but it doesn't work. You're not going to have the grace of God if you only love those who love you, your family and your friends, etc. You have to love other people that are outside of your immediate environment. So anyway, we'll have to do that next week because we're out of time this week. And until then, peace on your house, and may God be with you. God bless.
You have been listening to The Keys of the Kingdom with Brother Gregory of His Holy Church. For more information on the educational ministry provided by His Holy Church and Brother Gregory, including services, counseling, lectures, books, and other audio materials, please write to His Church at Summer Lake, Box 10, Summer Lake, Oregon, 97640. You can also find us on the web at www.hisholychurch.net.